This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up later this hour, Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters are headed back to the Triad for more great 50s and 60s rock, soul, blues, and R&B than we deserve, and Winston-Salem's Caleb Caudle has not been coddled. He's been paying his dues on the road big time, and the result is music to our ears. Before we get to the music, though, we'll dip into the movie house with our own technical producer and resident film geek, Eddie Garcia.
The majestic landscapes of Iceland form the unexpected backdrop of the new film Land Ho. It's a story about two men in their 70s who go on an odd couple-style jaunt through the cities and countryside of Iceland. It's a buddy comedy and also a touching exploration of friendships and how they evolve through the years. The film was co-written and co-directed by Martha Stevens and Aaron Katz. The two met 12 years ago at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, where they were studying film. Land Ho is screening in Winston-Salem starting September 5th. Visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for showtimes and to see clips from the movie. I spoke with Martha Stevens, one half of the Land Ho directing writing duo, and we began by talking about her UNCSA experience.
Aaron and I met 12 years ago at the film school. And both of us, I think, had a really good experience there. It was the type of school where someone like myself could flourish. You know, I don't know how well I would do at a place like NYU or UCLA, like a bigger school. It was more intimate, I guess, there. And at the time, I mean, Winston-Salem's much different now, but 12 years ago, there was nothing going on downtown in Winston-Salem. So there weren't as many distractions, I guess. So I think that, you know, that really made us, you know, bond. Like, you know, the people that we still work with now that we went to school with, we really bonded over being isolated, I guess. So that was a good experience. And Aaron and I have, this is the first time either of us have co-wrote or co-directed anything with anybody else. We typically do our own projects, but for the sake of, you know, just making something fun, we thought it would be fun to try to collaborate for once.
And what is that like, co-writing and co-directing? I mean, are duties divvied up in a really specific way, or is it more of a natural, organic process when you begin working together?
I mean, when you think about co-directors, you know, they tend to be related in some way. You know, you think of the Coen brothers, people like that. So I think it's like you really just need sort of your own shorthand language with one another. You needed to know each other really well. And we didn't divvy up, you know, jobs on set. It was more organic than that, I guess. We shot the first 5 minutes of the movie in Kentucky a few months before we went to Iceland. And that was sort of a way to test the waters a little bit to see how we would work. And, you know, sometimes I would go over to the camera and then Aaron would go over and talk to the actors and vice versa. I mean, it was just, nothing was really planned. It was just flowing like that.
And what about as far as writing?
I guess I had the idea. I called Aaron up and I was like, I have a crazy idea for a movie, but we should make a movie in Iceland and we should take Erlin to Iceland. Erlin plays Mitch. And from there, we started talking on the phone every day about, you know, developing the characters and the comedy. And once we did that, I wrote an outline, and I handed off the outline to Aaron because I went to Iceland, and Aaron didn't, and I location scouted specifically for the movie. So I wrote with all these locations in mind that I had seen while I was there, and then Aaron did, I think, the first draft, and then we passed it back and forth. Erlin's been in my other movies, so sometimes I went in and finessed his dialogue to be a little more Erlin-ish, I guess.
What inspired you to tell this story? It's a really unique, adventure or buddy film. So what sparked the idea?
I think really just wanting to make a movie starring these two guys. I mean, we wrote the script with both Erlin and Paul in mind, and we just wanted to make a movie about these two guys. You know, people keep asking us why we're making a movie, we're 30 years old and we're making a movie about, you know, baby boomers, but we don't really see it that way. We just find them to be really fun to watch, and we wanted you know, to share Erlend's humor. And, you know, I think Paul's really relatable, and I think it worked out. So,
yeah, it definitely did. And I was going to ask you, you know, what the casting process was like, because the actors portraying Colin and Mitch are perfect. But it sounds like you had a prior relationship with these guys, or you've worked with them before. Is that the case?
Well, Erlend is my cousin.
Okay.
He's my mom's first cousin. And so, yeah, he's been in all my films. And then Paul was in our Friends movie that played at Sundance the year prior. And so we had seen Paul in that movie, and we just thought he was really kind of special to watch. So we didn't really know Paul, but we knew, you know, I knew Erlend. But, you know, we talked to Paul about the project before we started pursuing it, to make sure he would be on board.
They give those type of performances that make someone say, like, oh, are they non-actors? Just because they're so natural and yet also seem to be just slightly aware that they're in a film. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but, like, there's this newness to the performance. I mean, are they new to acting, or have they both been acting, like, a long time?
Well, Erlend's not an actor. He's actually a surgeon in real life,
Oh, okay.
His character. And Paul is an actor. He's a professional actor. I think he, you know, had a pretty steady career going in Australia, and then he moved to the States when he, I think he married an American woman and moved to the States, and is based out of Seattle, and is, you know, doing small projects right now. He's hoping to break in and, you know, get some bigger roles, hopefully. But yeah, he's been doing it for a long time.
And with these characters, they're very distinct, very different. Mitch needs people. He's more outgoing. Colin's more restrained, maybe a little bit pent up. I know you were inspired by the gentlemen themselves, but was it difficult to write for such distinct personalities?
I think it's easier to write for distinct personalities and to write with, you know, your actors in mind and, you know, their little nuances and, you know, their... You can use some of their slang. I mean, I prefer it that way. I think it definitely makes it easier.
Okay. Let's talk about Mitch a little bit. He's kind of a randy, older gentleman. He has a really ribald sense of humor. Something I was thinking about while I was watching it is that it's an endearing character trait, and it's something that tweaked a little bit maybe wouldn't be so endearing. It seemed like that would have been difficult to get across, but once again, is it just because that's how he is and those are the kinds of jokes he makes, or...
Yeah, it's pretty similar to the way he is. I mean, it's all in good fun, you know. None of it is mean-spirited, and none of it is meant to be, like, creepy. Everyone that meets Erlend loves Erlend and thinks he's a sweetheart, so we were hoping that that would, you know, come across in the movie. I mean, I'm sure there are a few people who are offended, but sounds like that they have a problem if they find this offensive.
Well, I think it's a weird thing, though, because you don't hear that kind of dialogue and that age range and it not be something you're supposed to be concerned with. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Right.
So I think that's why it's, like, refreshing. But I think I could see how it could take a viewer a moment to be like, oh, okay, I mean, this is fine. I wasn't offended, but it's definitely,
yeah.
You know, the approach is different.
Well, it's, you know, it's all, but the thing that you realize in the movie is, like, it's all just talk, you know?
Yeah.
This is a guy that likes to present himself a certain way, and it makes him feel good about himself. But, you know, all in all, it's just talk, and he never acts on anything, and he's, you know, he's not a bad guy.
So. Yeah.
I have to tell you something that you might not like.
Okay, what?
I bought us 2 first-class tickets to Iceland. The hot springs, the juicy, fantastic lobsters, and the gorgeous broads.
I don't like lobster.
I'll eat your lobster.
Incredible location shooting. What was it like shooting in Iceland?
It was wonderful. I mean, being there was exciting. You know, most of our crew had never been to Iceland before. We brought, you know, most of our crew over from the States. We had some Icelandic crew members, but, you know, it was, like, invigorating, I guess, being there. You know, the air is so clean and wonderful, and, you know, there's a chill in the air that makes you feel really alive. So it was special. I would love to shoot there again.
Yeah.
They do things a little differently in terms of just basic production. They're a little more laid back. You know, Americans are notorious for being super high strung. And when you're making a movie, you're so high strung. So sometimes our Icelandic co-producers would be like, you all are really overreacting. It's okay. Things will get done. the location, you know, you will lock the location, don't worry, you know, and we're always like, go, go, go. And they don't answer their emails every day like we do. You know, yeah. we get offended if someone doesn't answer our email within, you know, 24 hours, and they go like a week without answering their email. And
between that and all the hot springs and spa, perhaps they have it figured out in a way we don't.
Exactly.
Were you guys able to take advantage of some of, you know, the natural, you know, the hot springs and things like that while you're shooting, or were you too busy?
We were too busy to do some of it. We did go to the abandoned geothermal pool on our day off and swam, and that was fun. And there are cool, like, communal swimming pools in Reykjavik with, like, hot pots. You can, it's kind of like a hot tub, but it's just really hot water. It's not bubbling. But it all feels really good, especially, you know, in October.
The music in the film, your use of music, particularly in montage or traveling scenes, it's either 80s music or music that's really reminiscent of 80s films. And I thought it was an interesting choice to have this beautiful, you know, natural imagery juxtaposed with bouncy, somewhat synthetic music. Was this at all a nod to some of the 80s films that they talk about?
I think, you know, once we got on, you know, set, what we realized while we were in pre-production in Iceland was that this movie was very much like, you know, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and some of the sort of 80s buddy movies. So that was, it was sort of a nod to the spirit of those movies, and, you know, the, also, like, you know, Twins, which they mention in the movie. I guess people would expect us to have music from maybe their generation or, you know, basic score, but we thought it was kind of a fun change to do something a little more pop music, you know?
Yeah. They talk about movies a lot too. Is that something that has developed naturally?
Yeah. Well, when we shot the Kentucky scene, they started talking about movies randomly. And so then we decided to incorporate that a little more because it was pretty funny to hear them talk about, you know, a lot of movies that were released like 20 years ago. So it's funny because they're kind of out of touch, you know.
Yeah.
They're not really talking about contemporary film. They're bringing up Pretty Woman and Sleepless in Seattle. And I think that that's funny.
We've lost track of the hotel.
I don't know why I listen to what you say, Mitch.
This is like one of those horror movies.
Did you connect with Sony Pictures Classics before you shot the film, or was this afterwards you got a distribution deal with them?
I believe our, you know, our sales agent that was working with us at Sundance had sent screeners of the film around to different distribution companies. And, you know, I think they actually prefer, though, to see the movie with an audience at Sundance. So Tom Bernard from Sony saw our premiere, and I think that he made his decision there and then brought it to Michael Barker, the guy that he runs SPC with, and Michael watched it at his condo, and they made their decision there.
I noticed that the executive producer was David Gordon Green, who also went to School of the Arts. How did he get involved?
David's kind of, you know, been a great, you know, mentor to both, you know, Aaron and myself. And he came on as like sort of a creative consultant. You know, we tossed the idea over to him and he said we should make it. And then we, you know, showed him early cuts of the movie and he, you know, told us what he thought. And yeah, he's just kind of been like he's sort of been someone we've been speaking to and getting advice from. And, you know, of course, it helps to have his name on the movie. So,
yeah,
I mean, he's a great guy. He's the most supportive guy. You know, most people, when they get to sort of his, like where he is, they're too busy to take time out to talk to people that are, you know, smaller than them. But David's not like that at all.
For current film students or, you know, people in our listening area that might be listening who attend School of the Arts or in the film program, you know, any words of wisdom as they finish school and set out on their careers?
I mean, it's hard because it's, you know, the landscape is always changing. And, you know, when I got out of school, it's, you know, it was making independent films is much different than it is even right now because it, you know, accessibility, and it's so easy to make, not easy to make movies now, but you have, you know, things at your fingertips to make movies now. And I guess what I would just say is, like, don't get discouraged. You know, one thing I remember is getting out of school and just kind of being like, whoa, what do I do now as a director? Because I didn't have like a specific skill that I could go, you know, use to make a living. And I think it's just about persistence. I mean, this is cheesy, but just trying, just really continuing to try and to not let yourself, you know, quit, I guess. And make things and write things and practice. If you don't sit down and write constantly, then you're going to be rusty. So just always keep yourself well oiled in that way.
Yeah, well, that's great advice. Well, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with me today. And I wish you lots of success with the film. It's great. I hope it gets even wider distribution and lots of people get to see it.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Martha Stevens. Along with Aaron Katz, she co-wrote and co-directed the film Land Ho. You can see Land Ho at Aperture Cinema in downtown Winston-Salem starting September 5th. Visit WFDD.org for trailers, links to the film's website, and showtime information from Aperture.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we return from this short break, we've got some fantastic ear candy for you. First, it's seasoned veteran of the blues and master performer Lightnin' Charlie. He's headed to Greensboro with his band, The Upsetters, and they're taking numbers. Then up-and-comer Caleb Caudill's here with a taste of his new CD, Tobacco Town. It's jam-packed with what Blurt magazine calls jaw-droppingly fine songs. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and Winston-Salem native singer-songwriter Caleb Caudill's here with Eddie Garcia on the second half of the show. Caleb's got a new solo album out called Tobacco Town, and if you play your cards right, he may share a selection or two. But first, we've got a bead on a place in Greensboro where you can find some excellent barbecue and some even better blues to go along with it all weekend long. From Friday, September 5th through Sunday the 7th in downtown Greensboro, the East West Barbecue Fest's pitmasters will once again fill the streets with the succulent smells of slow-cooked barbecue, and the airwaves there will also vibrate from a dozen bands, among them Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters, whom we're sampling right now. The blues may be where lead singer-guitarist Lightnin' Charlie's heart truly lies, but the multi-instrumentalist is extremely versatile. Lightnin's musical roots run deep, and his exceptional musicianship allows him to perform 60s soul, 50s rock and roll, and rhythm and blues, and make each style his own.
Marie, Marie, playing guitar on the back porch, I sit in my car.
That's Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters covering Marie Marie by the Blasters. This weekend, Lightnin' and his Tennessee-based band will return to the Triad for the first time in more than a decade at the East West Barbecue Fest in Greensboro.
To the bright lights downtown, Marie Marie.
It's been 10 years or better, 10 or 12 years since Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters has played in North Carolina. We've continued to play music full-time, but just haven't had the opportunity to be back over there. And the Triad was our home away from home, you know, for two decades. You know, I never lived there, but I loved there. I played there. I even went to jail there. and so, you know, I was like your adopted Tennessee SOB. That's son of the blues. And so our first experience over there in the Triad, we won the Piedmont Blues Preservation Society's contest. After that, just kept touring through there, and we played the Carolina Blues Fest. We played the Durham Bull Stadium with Bobby Bland and Dr. John. We played Ziggy's and Double Door, and we played Furniture Markets in High Point for 15 years. And so it's going to be great for us to come back and see a lot of our old Lightnin' bugs, as we call our fans, that we haven't seen in such a long time.
Because I know years on the road, it can be tough. In fact, You chronicled much of the reality of being on tour in your book, Off the Record, The Trials and Tribulations of a Traveling Troubadour.
It's been a real gas for me having the book. It was originally blogs on my website that I would do monthly, and I did that for about 3 years, and then ended up compiling it into a book, and it got immediately picked up by a publisher, and so now it's in its second edition. It's in over 18,000 bookstores worldwide, and it's just a hilarious read. It's a collection of short stories documenting my life on the road as a musician and as a husband and a father, and it's 455 pages of gut laughs, really, that, you know, Stephen King couldn't make up the kind of stuff that's contained in the book, you know?
Yeah. Could you give us a picture of that life and maybe some of the, you know, the big rewards that you've experienced as a man traveling?
Well, you know, I like to tell folks, David, that I'm in the fun business. That is, you know, I play good music for good people, and if people see the show and don't have fun, then I've not done my job. And having made a living playing music and being a band leader and a showman and everything for, this is my 30th year, you know, it is a challenge. It's, you know, the best of times, worst of times. I can't imagine doing anything else. It's been in my blood since I was a little kid. And it's difficult. The travel is particularly difficult, which I've curtailed quite a bit. And I'm still playing, well, between 200 to 250 shows a year, every year, most of which are solo shows, acoustic, unplugged things, or duos with my wife, and locally to me in East Tennessee. But, you know, the blues in particular is a tough way to make a living. The money aspect of it aside, the blues has fallen really on hard times lately, as I think that a lot of, not just the blues, but a lot of music has suffered because of just the kind of deterioration of venues and audiences, and economically things are tough, and people don't have the discretionary money to go out and see a show like they once did. It's tough. It's tough times. And one thing about your area, about the Triad, and again, I don't have experience over there in the last 10 years or so, but it was always the case before that you really had a terrific and vital music scene over there, including the blues. It was real refreshing for me. I remember first coming over there to play the Piedmont Blues Society contest, just, you know, green as a pool table, you know, twice as square. We didn't know anything about, you know, that area or the scene there, and knew nothing about, you know, blues societies either. We went over there to play in that contest as kind of a lark and wasn't expecting anything, and won the contest and was immediately, you know, plunged into playing all these, you know, really big festivals. We played the Memphis Blues Festival, the Carolina Blues Festival over there, and was exposed to a real vibrant and living blues scene. And it was so refreshing for us because a lot of times we're playing music to people in nightclubs that, or we were at that time, that wouldn't know the blues if the blues bit them, you know? They couldn't pick Muddy Waters out of a lineup, you know?
Yeah.
They don't know the blues, but once they would hear it, they would dig it.
I said, hey, pretty girl, don't you understand? Hey,
looking at Marie Marie, and I mean, a complete shift of style with this one by the Blasters, but the, I mean, the tune fits your voice so well, it sounds as if it were written for you.
Oh, well, that's very, very nice.
Well, I've really enjoyed the listening to it, and I guess that is, you're walking a fine line there. You do it so well, it doesn't seem like you're walking a fine line, but how do you all manage to cover, you know, all these styles and artists without sounding, you know, derivative or like you're imitating, and it really sounds creative in the moment?
That, I suppose, David, goes back to that musical education of mine. And as a child, just, you know, consuming and all of this stuff, chewing it up, digesting it, you know, and spitting it out, it sounds years, decades later, like me, whatever that is. You know, I played a show for PBS television one time. It's a national concert series on PBS, and one of the things that they required was in advance was a short bio, you know, of the artists that were going to be appearing, and I sent my bio to the production people. It was a New York-based production company, and we went and did the show, and it was like a 15 or 20 minute set, and it was a solo thing on an acoustic guitar, and so I'm playing some Delta blues. I played a song that is on my new Leaf record that I think is one of the ones that you have called Blueser to Blame. It's a slide guitar thing. Played some Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers, you know, gospel music. Did some rock and roll. Did basically what I do every night is an amalgam of these atomic-powered roots music, you know. And after the set, the producer asked me to come onto the mobile truck, the recording truck, and I thought something was wrong. You know, they got me as I come off stage and said, you know, that he wants to see you in the truck. And I thought, oh, no. And I went onto the mobile truck, and this guy, you know, pulled his headphones off, and he said, you know, when I read your bio, and it said you did everything from Hank Williams to Mahalia Jackson, he said, I didn't like you. I didn't want to like you. It sounded like the biggest mishmash of styles that I hated it. I hated you before I even saw you. And he said, after you were on stage tonight for about 30 seconds, he said, I got it. He says, it all comes out just sounding like you. And I don't know really what that X factor is, but I know as an artist, you have got to take from traditional forms and the artists that came before you and somehow use it and make that gumbo that comes out sounding like yourself, because, you know, there's enough imitators, you know, in the world. You got to have something original. It's got to be something new, you know.
Well, that old adage, don't judge a book by its cover. I mean, that
yeah, Bo Diddley. You know, it's a tough thing, you know. And when I was starting out, you know, like most people, all you have is imitation. I would listen to some artist that I loved. If I'm listening to Elvis or Stevie Ray play a guitar part, or, you know, all you have is the imitation at some point in your artistic development, or at least I did. I'm sure there's, you know, prodigies that, you know, come out of the womb and they're Duke Ellington or somebody, but you imitate. And I was one of those kids putting the needle back a half an inch on the record, you know, getting that guitar line, you know, over and over that 10 seconds and backing it up and backing it up and learning it note for note. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you've got to do that. You've got to study. I mean, if someone's going to be an architect, they need to study Frank Lloyd Wright, you know. If you're a writer, you need to get some Mark Twain and some Hemingway and some Steinbeck. You know, you've got to imitate that which turns you on artistically and emotionally, and then go from there. And hopefully you can come up with something that's, you know, new.
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, you got a boy child coming, he's gonna be a son of a gun.
Most listeners, even non-blues aficionados, have heard the name Muddy Waters many, many times. Legendary blues, from Mississippi Delta blues. And what about his approach to the instrument or vocally grabbed your attention? And maybe you could give us a sample of something that you've lopped onto with his approach.
Wow, Muddy, the king in my heart of hearts for the blues. Muddy Waters is still tops for me. There's something about his melding of his Delta roots with a 50s smoking electric combo. It was just the A-team of the blues. I mean, his sidemen, you know, I mean, Jimmy Rogers and Span and Little Walter and, I mean, that 50s band that I think is, without question, the greatest Chicago blues band ever assembled. I don't know that there's anybody that can really argue that. And his songwriting, you know, with Willie Dixon, you know, it was just a combination of talents that I think is unsurpassed in the blues. And I never, ever, ever get tired of hearing Muddy Waters. Vocally, he just had that thing that he could make his voice do anything, so unique. And he had that stutter, ha 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 ha, and she was saying, and he would just preach, you know. And I mean, that comes, a lot of that stuff, and in the early blues, that comes from the church. And Muddy is just, I was just peerless to me. In my heart, he is just the king of the blues.
And that you see, I got $700. Don't you mess with me, but you know I'm down. Everybody knows I'm down. Well, you know the hoochie coochie man.
Let's jump ahead. And I was thinking Johnny Lee Hooker also was one who definitely threw in a stutter now and again.
Yeah, boy, and that's try to imitate John Lee Hooker. It's these guys were so, I mean, their genius was so huge, brilliant. Hooker, you know, I saw John Lee Hooker at a little club late in his career here in Tennessee, and he had been sick. You know, he was sitting down for the show, and they had put, it's a listening room, a lot of singer-songwriters and, you know, bands and things, but tables and chairs, and they put folding chairs in rows to make seating for the amount of people that wanted to buy tickets. And so the place was just jammed, and Hooker is sitting down on stage, you know, with his band and playing, and he came out after the intermission for the second set, and he says, and it's a small club, you know, 300 people, and he had him a glass of beer, and he came out and he said, the doctor told me not, I wasn't supposed to drink any beer anymore, but you people have made me feel so good that I just wanted to share a glass of beer with you. And he held out the beer mug and a toast, and the entire room stood, you know, instantly and immediately, spontaneously with him in this toast. And it was amazing to me. It was, you know, just watching someone who had such command without any baloney, you know, no histrionics and no theatrical baloney. He was just so real and so communicating with an audience one-to-one. You know, I learned a lot watching Hooker at that show. He just treated the audience like he was sitting in his living room, you know, talking to them. And, of course, he's talking to them with his guitar and songs.
One bourbon, one scotch, and one bill. Hey, Mr. Bartender, come here. I want another drink and I want it now. My baby, she gone.
Well, let's jump back to Chicago for a minute. Buddy Guy was a fellow who I got a chance to see quite a bit when I was living there, and I know he's influenced a whole slew of guitarists, Buddy, and singers throughout. What about his approach to either, you know, crazy guitar playing or vocalizing that grabs your imagination?
The thing about Buddy that I love is his just absolute abandon on guitar and vocally. His just wild man approach to music, the freedom of expression that Buddy shows in his music, and that West Side Soul thing that I've always been a huge fan of, you know, with Buddy and Magic Sam Maguette and Otis Rush and the guys that took Southside Chicago blues stylings and combined it, you know, in the mid-60s and late-60s with that, the whole soul explosion that was happening, and that melding of gritty Southside Chicago blues with the soul stuff. And that's where, you know, Buddy and Junior, you know, were such a great team together doing that stuff like nobody else has ever been able to do, mixing, you know, Chicago blues with James Brownish soul music. He's just great. Love Buddy. I love the 50s stuff. I love his 60s stuff. You know, he's one of those guys that has really evolved through the years as an artist. And God, you know. Every guitar player wants to be Buddy Guy.
Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters return to the Triad Saturday night, September 6th, from 5:45 to 7:15 during Greensboro's East West Barbecue Fest, 200 North Davy Street. Live music by a dozen bands, sideshows, markets, and more. Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters won the Piedmont Blues Preservation Society Blues Contest. Ricky Skagg says they don't sound good, they sound great. And Marquee Magazine readers have voted Lightnin' Charlie and the Upsetters' favorite musician or group in the Mountain South for several years in a row. You'll find more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. More great music on the way with Caleb Caudill, so stick around.
I'm Eddie Garcia, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. The Harvest Moon Festival is an annual event featuring art, food, and music on the Rinalda House lawn. This year's festival is on Thursday, September 11th, and will feature a keepsake art activity, microbrew beer, free tastings, and food trucks. The entertainment this year comes courtesy of my guest, Caleb Caudill.
There's a place no light creeps in. Leaves don't fall and the wheels just spin. Yesterday's our pile and fade. Love and pain seems just the same. There's a place that I've been to.
Caleb Caudill is a Winston-Salem native who honed his songcraft playing in bands in the area, but he's since gone solo and has been making an impact nationally on the Americana circuit. He's played hundreds of shows over the past few years, and those experiences and dedication to his craft have led to his new album, Paint Another Layer on My Heart. Visit WFDD.org for links for tickets and to see the video for the song Trade All the Lights. Caleb was living in New Orleans, but now, when he's not on the road, he hangs his hat in his hometown of Winston-Salem. Earlier this week, we sat down to talk about life on the road and the inspirations and musicians behind his new record.
I recorded it back in December up at Echo Mountain in Asheville. And I had put together a great band. We had a lot of the guys from Roseland who are out of Greensboro. You might know them also from House of Fools. Jordan Powers and Jack Foster from Roseland and also Tommy Cyphers played guitar on it. And then I had my friend Greg Herndon play some keys. Whit Wright from American Aquarium played pedal steel, and Lydia Lovelace sang harmonies on it.
Yeah, I was really curious because you've mainly been playing solo shows for the most part. Great band that you're playing with. Have you done some shows with them too?
Yeah, a lot of those guys are backing me up coming up on the 11th at the Harvest Moon Festival, and then the next night in Charlotte we're playing together. But yeah, a lot of touring that I'm doing right now is solo still.
Okay. And you've been touring pretty relentlessly over the past year or so. What would you say, 2 years?
Probably about 2 years now.
About 2 years. So, do you know how many shows you've played in that time?
Last year I did 230 shows. And then this year I've, the record came out June 24th and I've done about 50 shows since then. So, and I toured earlier in the year too. So, I mean, it's been quite at least 400 shows in the last 2 years.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. That's a lot of shows. I'm sure you've learned all kinds of things and have tons of experiences along the way.
Yeah.
What have you learned about songwriting along the way?
I've learned a lot touring solo because you start to learn what goes over in a small room of loud people and what doesn't. And I feel like my voice has changed a little bit because I try to write now in a way where I'm projecting, to the point where it would catch someone's attention, even if they were, chatting to their buddy over beers or whatever.
That's interesting. So, I mean, is there a loss of intimacy then or not? Because you're really pulling more people in that way.
Not at all. Usually if a room's really loud, I'll play really quiet and just try to bring the whole volume down. And you can usually take over a room that way. And I feel like it's gotten easier for me to learn how to take over rooms, and some just aren't, meant to be taken over. I mean, sometimes, I mean, John Prine could play in some of the rooms I'm playing in, and it would still be a dull roar behind him, I think. Yeah, but, you know, it's just kind of how it goes, I guess.
Being solo, are you talking a lot between your songs? You have, like, stories to tell, or you're letting the music do the talking for the most part? I'm curious.
I usually try to talk quite a bit. I played in Atlanta this past Saturday, and it was a literary event, and so I felt a little bit pressured to tell some stories when I should have probably just sang songs. But no, I think it went over well, and it just kind of depends on the crowd. And if it's a good listening crowd, which I've been fortunate to have a lot more of as of late, you know, I feel a little bit more at ease telling stories in between songs and kind of giving people the background of everything.
And what was that literary event for? What was that?
It was a blog called The Bitter Southerner, and it's based out of Atlanta, and it's just, you know, good progressive southern blog, and they highlight chefs and authors and just all good things from the south pretty much.
Now, you're from here, you lived in New Orleans for a while, you were touring a lot. That was your home base, I guess.
Yeah.
You'd say. But you're back in Winston now.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back to Winston?
A lot of reasons, but you know, I kind of just missed North Carolina. It's a good place to tour out of. It's a good central hub for the East Coast, and I can pop over to Nashville pretty quickly as well, which I feel like I'm there quite a bit.
And so you're popping over to Nashville quite a bit. Is that is that a label affiliation thing, or you mean you're just having lots of shows over there?
A lot of shows over there, then occasionally some co-writing opportunities over there that I've had people come ask me to, you know, drive over and do some writing with them, and so I go do that.
Now, the label you are on is This Is American Music, yeah, which is based out of Atlanta. Tell me a little bit about them and how you got hooked up with them.
They're a great Southern indie label, and I mean, I think they kind of base their whole layout after, I know all those guys are big fans of Merge Records out of Chapel Hill. I got some great label mates on there, Glossary and Hooray for the Riff Raff put out some stuff through there, and there's a band called Fire Mountain out of Alabama that I really like that's on there. And I don't know, it's good. It's you feel like you're kind of part of this little club of songwriters that, you know, for me, I really enjoy what they're doing. And great dudes, you know.
Beyond this, the playing itself, what's one of the great things about doing as much touring as you've been doing?
You know, just connecting with people and seeing that there's, you know, I feel like I did this in my bedroom for so long, just playing these songs and playing guitar and not really touring that often. And then now it's just good to know that there's a crowd out there. There's people that want to connect to what you're doing. And that's really important to me. You know, it's kind of all I've ever wanted to do from the beginning of it all. And it's nice that it's actually happening.
So. Yeah. I'm hearing, for some reason, I'm hearing a little more Bruce Springsteen in you than I have in the past.
Oh, really?
Is that weird? Have you heard that before?
You know what? I have heard it, and I'm a big fan of his, so I actually just played in Asbury Park up at this place called The Saint in July, I believe, or maybe it was June, and his original drummer, Mad Dog, was at the show, and I got this picture with him he wanted to recreate. He has this picture of him and Bruce where he's biting Bruce's hat, which was a big hat like I tend to wear a lot. And he came up to me and he's like, hey, I got this picture of, he's like, me and Bruce were posing, and right before someone took the picture, I bit his hat, can I recreate that? And I was like, absolutely, we can recreate that. And he's wearing his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame hat, and I'm, you know, getting my hat bit by him. He was a pretty hilarious guy.
That's the weirdest passing of the torch.
Yeah.
In a way, passing of the tooth.
Right.
So on this album, as I was listening to it, I mean, you've always written songs that are about what can go right and wrong, about romances, you know, a lot in there. But I can't help but feel that you've been on the road so much, and there's a lot of the songs are about longing and being on the road and things like that and missing people. I mean, how does this kind of new life you've carved for yourself, how is it changing your, you know, personal relationships and dynamics with people?
I think that more than anything, you start to really value the time you get to spend with people. And that's something that's really been highlighted, I think, for me, and like, and places as well. You know, you start to fall in love with places because you're, you know, I'll hit these places one or two, three times a year. And, you know, certain places are like, wow, you know, this is kind of like third, fourth home, you know? So you start to miss. It's weird because you're missing home, but you're also like missing all these new places too. Mm-hmm. Like every time I leave Nashville, I'm like, oh, you know, because I just have some great friend circle out there, and everyone out there is just pushing themselves especially in my genre, just to the limits. And I feel really fortunate to be involved in with a bunch of people who are doing a lot of really great things there. So.
Dreams of chimney smoke and exhaust from tailpipes. Syracuse seems so far away. It's mid-30s and raining here at Fort Jackson. I miss the snowy streets, how it wastes away the days. And on the back seat of a bus in a suit of green, shaky hands, your letters in my coat.
Do you think the album's thematically linked in any way?
You know, I write very inward, so I'm writing about what I'm going through. So in that way, I think, yeah, probably they're all linked up because it's just a timeline. I just finished some shows with Justin Townes Earl in Alabama, and we were talking about how, you know, we try to, it's kind of like a snapshot of your life. That's what we try to make. We were both saying we both kind of write that way, and I found that to be pretty interesting. It's nice, and I feel like that's the kind of records I love, so that's probably why I'm trying to recreate that. If I can see, like, 6 months of someone's life, it's really interesting to me.
Yeah. When you sit down to write, do you have a rigid songwriting process, or...?
I write a lot when I'm driving, especially nowadays since I'm doing it so much, and I have some apps on my phone, like Quick Voice, it's a little recorder, and I'll just hit record, and then I'll just... kind of crazily, you know, talk into it and just like talk lyrics. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, go back through at the end of a tour, I'll have all these things on my notepad and like little sound bites, and I'll kind of sift through them all. I'm like, what's a good idea for a song? Can I make anything work? And some of it's really silly because it's 4 a.m. and I'm driving and I'm like, wow, I was just kind of out of my mind on coffee and, you know, this doesn't make sense. But some of it comes out and I'm like, hey, you know, I could probably mold something out of that and turn it into something.
Fingerprints on windows, Christmas trees on top of cars, details of a lonely night to remind me I'm not where you are.
You've been supporting a lot of pretty well-known artists in your circuit, which I guess we'd call what, the Americana,
right,
singer-songwriter,
yeah,
type of thing. Who you know, tell our listeners about some of these people you've played with.
One of the guys that I've played with a few times that's probably getting the most recognition right now is Jason Isbell, who was in the Drive-By Truckers for a while, and now he just put out a great record last year called Southeastern. So I played some shows with him, with Steve Earle's son, Justin Townes, and you know, Dawes, Lucero, Felice Brothers. Just, I mean, you know, I've been pretty fortunate just getting these opening slots, and I'm about to do a Midwestern tour with a guy named Austin Lucas that I really like, and my buddy John Moreland. I've been touring with him a lot, and he's out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he's doing really well right now.
What do you think you're picking up from these guys and gals?
You know, yeah, a lot of things. You know, like when you tour with somebody, you start picking up on, even if it's just like nothing to do with songs, just banter or like the way they carry themselves, or, you know, and you, I feel like, and it's a two-way street. I'm sure they're picking up stuff from me and I'm picking up stuff from them, and it kind of just, it's just a natural thing. And, you know, what I've noticed lately is like all the people that I'm listening to constantly are just my friends now. And that's been a really cool thing that's happened over the last couple years or so. And
you're really driven. I mean, what's the goal? Not that there has to be an end game in sight, but I mean, what's your goal ultimately?
I mean, it's constantly adapting. I think that was the whole deal. You know, my goal 4 years ago would have been where I was at 2 years ago. So, I mean, you know, I guess the ultimate goal was to do music for a living. And that's what I'd always said. But now that I've been doing that for about a year and a half or 2 years, it's you know, it's changed. And now I just want to just reach an audience who feels affected, you know, by the songs and by the records, and you know, just having that human connection, I think it's just so important, and I think it's something that everyone's longing for, and at least I know that I am. So if I can make somebody feel the way I feel when I listen to someone like Townes Van Zandt or John Prine or these people that just kind of like changed my world, if I can make somebody else feel any even close to that, you know, that's kind of the goal, I think, now. To be there tonight with you in New Orleans, floating like ghosts through the town, Spanish boats tumbling round. Oh, I'd trade all the lights, trade all the lights, I'd trade all the lights for you.
Singer-songwriter Caleb Cottle. He'll be playing at the Harvest Moon Festival on Thursday, September 11th. His new album, Paint Another Layer on My Heart, is available now on iTunes, Bandcamp, and in stores on CD and a soon-to-be-released vinyl. Caleb spends more time on the road than off, and you'll find links to his tour dates and info on the Harvest Moon Festival at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our executive producer is David Ford, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.